after year.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, my name is Jim Butts from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you the reading from Reminisce magazine. So getting started today, this is a note from the editor of Reminisce magazine. I thought you might share with you this viewpoint. She's called Turning Points. This is by Linda Cast. Home economics was somehow not a course on my mother's high school schedule. But after she got married and had six children who were younger than 12, she quickly concluded that sewing was a handy skill to have. So she bought a sewing machine and learned to use it. Intrigued by the possibilities, I begged her to teach me too. I loved picking out patterns and fabric, and finally I could make clothes that fit. I'm 5 feet tall, so clothes are always oddly proportioned and way too long for me. Another benefit, I could stretch my 50 cents an hour babysitting wage. So if crafts are one of your talents, you'll want to check in on the Reminisce magazine section in Stitches. She writes, learning to make my own clothes was a clear-cut turning point in my life. I met people with similar interests, developed more confidence, and found a unique way to express myself. Whether you call them turning points or rites of passage, major life changes can include everything from getting your driver's license to joining the Peace Corps. Our readers share these and other life-altering experiences when everything changed. Although we can't stop the world around us from changing, some things are precious enough to preserve. One is a neighborhood diner, the spot where locals grab a cup of joe and kibitz with the waitress or the short order cook. You can relive those happy days and serve up a refresher course in dinner slang. There's a lot more to love in this issue, so kick back, relax, and reminisce with us. Here's a reminiscing story about a close encounter by David Neil Keller of Dublin, Ohio. He skipped the formalities. She preferred being with people who just happened to come by. He writes, working on the Ohio University's administrative staff in the spring of 1954, I was assigned to meet former First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt at the Columbus Airport. Accompanied by Richard Bitters, Director of Press Relations, we were to drive her to the swanky University Club in Columbus for lunch, before escorting her 75 miles south to the Athens campus. When Mrs. Roosevelt was a delegate to the UN General Assembly, our university president, John C. Baker, served as the first chief American representative to UNESCO. Like many others, Dr. Baker was greatly moved by her efforts as head of the Human Rights Commission. Their friendship enabled him to convince the woman he considered one of the world's greatest humanitarians to give a speech at the Central Auditorium of Ohio's oldest university. The speech would be broadcast on public radio. All went well until Mrs. Roosevelt got off the plane. When Dick and I explained the lunch arrangements, she politely protested. Instead of a fancy luncheon, she preferred to have lunch among folks who'd just happened to come by. Do you know of a fast food place? We called our president, who answered right away. Dick launched into a rapid-fire explanation about why Mrs. Roosevelt would miss out on the meeting with state dignitaries. Baker broke in. Whoa, Dick. Before you and Dave share heart attacks, let me explain. The lunch, he told us, was part of a regularly scheduled Ohio College Presidents Association meeting, and everyone would understand. She truly is a person of the people, Baker said, so take care of her. Over the years, where we ate has faded, but the experience was unforgettable. Sitting at a corner booth, whenever someone approached, Mrs. Roosevelt would smile and say, "Yes, I'm Eleanor Roosevelt. And what is your name?" Then she exchanged a friendly greeting before asking questions about their lives. Somehow, we managed to finish our meal. Eleanor Roosevelt may have had detractors, but I can guarantee there weren't any in that restaurant on April 26, 1954. And to attest to her, hanging in our house is a quote by her that says something to the effect of, "There are many people who come in and out of your lives, but only true friends have a place in your heart." Let's move along here to another story from Family Fun Time. This is by Steve Melton of Dallas, Texas. Pride and place kept them together. All seven of my aunts and uncles live close to us in Dallas, Texas, where I grew up in the 1950s and 60s. I could ride my bike to four of their houses. We had wonderful family gatherings on Thanksgiving, Christmas, and Easter, and birthday parties almost monthly. In spring, after we finished our meal, the guys would go outside to play football. My uncle was a high school football star, and I thought no one could throw a pass like him. Sometimes we even let our aunts play. Another uncle would stand on his head in the middle of the living room floor. I'm not sure why he did this, but I was impressed. A third uncle managed the first grocery store in town that sold non-food items. One cousin was a cadet at Texas A&M and wore an official-looking uniform, while another was a school librarian. And another cousin had a 57 Chevy that sped down the street like a rocket. That is, if his parents weren't around. In the summer, we'd make ice cream. My sister and I would take turns cranking the machine, sitting on it for ballast. The cousins also got in on the act. We played the whole time we were together, while the grown-ups talked and did boring adults stuff. When I got older, I began to really appreciate those gatherings. My aunts made amazing desserts and served sweet tea. My uncles could take afternoon naps, which sounded boring back then, but perfect now. Oh, how I miss those days. That's by Steve Melton of Dallas, Texas. And here's one from Hebron, Ohio, hoofing it on the ballroom floor. John Cooperrider of Huxit, New Hampshire writes, "Being a teenager during World War II in Hebron, a small town in central Ohio, presented a special employment opportunity for me and my contemporaries. Everyone just a few years older than us either was inducted into the service or employed by one of the defense plants that had cropped up. As a result, jobs not previously available to kids were ours for the asking. Nearby was an amusement park called Buckeye Lake, also known as the Playground of Ohio. The park had a variety of rides, concessions, games, and eateries, as well as a skating rink and two dance halls. The plethora of jobs there was amazing, and the laws covering child labor were much more relaxed than they are today. I began working in 1944 when I was 14 at a dance hall, the Crystal Ballroom. As a floor manager, I supervised 10 ticket takers, mopped and treated the dance floor with cornmeal and shaved paraffin, and set up music stands and the microphones. A house band was booked for the entire summer. However, big-name bands such as the Dorsey Brothers, Benny Goodman, Harry James, Charlie Barnett, Gene Krupa, and even Spike Jones made occasional appearances. We used a dime-a-dance ticket system with the house band. With big names, however, we charged a general admission fee, but dancing was free. After each dance number, I hustled everyone off the dance floor. I also made sure that no one was inebriated and that the dancing didn't get excessively vigorous. The jitterbug was big, and at times people overdid it. We worked 7 days a week from 7 p.m. until it closed at 1 a.m., then we walked 2 miles home along a busy highway full of drivers who had been doing their fair of drinking that night. I worked there for 3 years before joining the Navy when I turned 17. There is no way parents would allow their kids to do that today. by John Cooperrider of Hoxett, New Hampshire. Now from Essex Junction, Vermont, Dick Bora writes, his impulse panned out, a down-to-earth chat with a genius was possible. Annual tuition in 1942 at Princeton University in New Jersey was $450, a financial stretch for my dad, so I worked as a waiter in the dining halls for my board. At the end of my first year, I took a leave of absence and enlisted in the service along with about two-thirds of my classmates. I was ordered to the Stevens Institute of Technology in Hoboken, about 50 miles away, for further studies under the Navy's V-12 Officer Training Program. One Sunday in June of 1944, during liberty break from my studies and drills, I borrowed my father's car and drove back to Princeton to visit friends still on campus. One regret I had from my time as a student, I'd never seen Albert Einstein. He lived in town and worked at the Institute for Advanced Study. Cameron Hand, I ventured to his home at 112 Mercer Street. Locating the house was no problem. On a whim, I crossed the street and knocked on the door. A housekeeper answered the door, and I asked if Dr. Einstein lived there. She assured me he did and invited me in. She led me to the study and introduced Professor Einstein. He looked exactly like his photos, gray, white, unkempt hair, Teddy Roosevelt mustache, wrinkled sweatshirt, sad but twinkling eyes, baggy pants, sandals, curled pipe in his hand. Papers and books were piled on shelves, tables, and chairs everywhere. He cleared a space and motioned for me to sit down, asking if I would like to join him for some tea and crumpets. I said yes, of course. I don't recall being nervous in his presence. It was like having a conversation with my beloved German grandfather. Though he had a heavy accent, I could easily understand him. He put me completely at ease and asked about the math courses I was taking at the time. I spent the rest of the afternoon with the man who would become Time's Person of the Century and the only individual in history to immediately associated with and identifiable by a simple equation. Over the years, I've read about his life, his accomplishments, his humility, his wise philosophy, and his humorous antidotes. His place in history is unchallenged. His shining place in my memory will never dim. This is by Dick Bora of Essex Junction, Vermont. Closer look, sidebar here. Albert Einstein was born March 14th, 1879, in Ulm, Germany. He died April 18th, 1955, in Princeton, New Jersey. He changed modern physics in 1905 when he introduced his theory of relativity to the world. In 1921, he won the Nobel Prize in Physics for his explanation of the photoelectric effect. His most associated with the equation, I'm sure you know it, here it is, his most famous equation is E equals MC squared. Albert Einstein, what a genius. Now for a retro replay on stage, on with the show, a day at the Circus Museum sure beat the heat of Farm Chores by Sharon Moe Furl of Rio Rancho, New Mexico. She writes, my mother, father, and I took a day trip to Baraboo, Wisconsin, the original home of the Ringling brothers in early July 1959. We were living on a dairy farm outside Fort Atkinson, and this was one of those rare days when my father could get away from his chores. Circus World Museum, a tribute to Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus, had just opened, and the movie, The Big Circus, was premiering at the A1 Ringling Theater. Rhonda Fleming and several other stars were scheduled to attend the premiere. I was 15, and the thought of seeing a movie star close up was really exciting. We arrived in the morning and saw all the memorabilia of the bygone circus parades. And in the afternoon, we went to the movie premiere. There she was, Rhonda Fleming, with her red hair and blue polka dot dress, standing just a few feet away from me, signing autographs. That was one of the high points of my life. Fast forward 58 years to May 2017, when Ringling Brothers and Barnum Bailey Circus held its final performance. The museum in Baraboo is still open, though, and has added more circus treasures. But I'll always remember that special summer day in 1959. The next summer, I graduated from high school. My father died, and I headed for college. My adulthood had begun. The next story is from Gig Harbor, Washington, by Martha Carr, whose lasting impression, "Dinner plans change. Getting close to our food gave us a new perspective." She writes, "To get away from a stressful job as a school superintendent in the Southern California mountains, Dad retired and my parents, Ralph and Nancy Bell, moved to the San Juan Islands in Washington in about 1978. They wanted to live close to nature, growing their own vegetables, raising fruit and nut trees, and being self-sufficient. They bought a boat to catch fish. They found exactly what they wanted in a 6.5-acre plot across from a wild bird preserve. It had a well, barn, chicken coop, and corral, along with huge areas for planting and a forest at the rear edge. They bought 2 horses, several chickens, 4 lambs, and a goat. And they raised 3 beautiful fat turkeys. One was intended for Thanksgiving, one for Christmas, and one for Easter. They bought a large freezer to keep the birds after processing. Just before Thanksgiving, they prepped a picnic table to process all 3 turkeys. The plan was that once the birds were killed, Mom, Dad, and daughter Nancy would pluck the feathers and clean the carcasses. When it was time to pluck, however, they couldn't go on. How can we possibly eat the turkeys that ran up to greet us every morning? Mom asked. How can we eat the chickens who lay eggs for us every day? We buried the turkeys in the forest and had one, and we had Thanksgiving without one. And that is how my parents lived the rest of their 6 years on the island. They had such reverence for life that they could hardly kill a single living creature. The sheep who kept the grass trim became pets. One ewe died giving birth to twins, so we bottle-fed her lambs as they sat on our laps. When they were old enough to feed themselves, the lambs would come to the back door and call out, "Meh, meh, meh." Boy, forgive me for that one. The chickens died of old age. Our family did catch and eat fish, though Mom always found it distressing to clean them. When their remote location became too tricky for my parents to navigate, they resettled to Edmonds, Washington, but they never lost their appreciation for nature. And motoring memory time here, from riding a peacetime wave, "The ocean almost swallowed their fun," writes Evelyn Taylor of Leroy, New York. Neither Bryant nor I had ever owned a car. Few young people could afford one in the late 30s and early 40s, but when the war ended in 1945, domestic auto production picked up, so it was a good time to buy. Before our husbands were discharged from the Army, my sister-in-law and I decided to attend the opening of a Ford dealership to see the first models made for peacetime. The evening of the opening, it poured rain, but we set out anyway, and it happened that we were the only ones who showed up. The dealer gave us his full attention, and we each wound up ordering a car. About a week before Bryant came home, our Ford arrived, the first post-war one delivered in Leroy. It was a glorious moment when I took Brian out to the garage and surprised him with our new dark blue 2-door, 8-cylinder Ford. We immediately took it out for a drive. In his exuberance, Brian honked the horn so much it stuck. My husband was no mechanic, but after a few haphazard knocks under the hood, he got the thing to quit blaring. A week later, we started on a road trip to Florida. Wherever we drove, people stopped in their tracks to stare at us and wave. We were an oddity in this new world of peace. We stayed in Daytona to see the car races, and I drove for a stretch along the beach. As I turned to take us back, our front tire sank into the sand. Bryant tried, but the car sank even deeper. We stood there on the empty beach, uncertain what to do, when a boy on his bike warned us that the tide was coming in. The week before, he said a car had sunk out of sight at high tide. Frantic, Bryant ran for help while I was left to pace around the car as the Atlantic lapped even nearer. I don't know how long it was. It seemed like an eternity before I saw Bryant running toward me with six sailors he'd found in a bar. They quickly pushed us onto Terra Firma. The rest of our journey of 3,000-plus miles went smoothly. Back in Leroy, Bryant took the car in for a checkup at the dealership, where everyone was amazed that we hadn't had any maintenance on it, not even an oil change in all those miles. I told you, Bryant was no mechanic. Thank you, Elvin Taylor from Leroy, New York. I suppose everyone who enjoys sports always takes a look at legends in certain sports and compares them with folks who are playing today. In the Spotlight section of Reminisce magazine today, the spotlight is on Joe Namath and Tom Brady. Of course, Tom Brady, as you know, just finished another Super Bowl run here. So the story goes, and this is by Mary Liz Shaw, pro football had no idea what was in store when Joseph William Namath was born in Pennsylvania Steel Town in 1943. In a few short years, the kid with the bullet arm, lush hair would turn the staid gridiron on its crew-cut head. It wasn't just his legendary win with the New York Jets in the Super Bowl III 50 years ago, an unabashed swinger with a million-watt smile. Broadway Joe was the most 1960s guy ever. The very married Tom Brady of the New England Patriots is a choir boy by comparison, but on the field, he'll go for broke in the pocket like Joe every time. Here's a little comparison chart here. Say Joe Namath was born May 31st, 1943. Brady was born August 3, 1977. The birthplace, Joe Namath was born in Beaver Falls, Pennsylvania. Tom in San Mateo, California. Nicknames. Namath was Broadway Joe, Joe Willie. And Tom Brady's was Tom Terrific, Touchdown Tom, The Pharaoh, Comeback Kid, and Goat. College. Joe was University of Alabama. Brady, University of Michigan. The draft pick. Joe was in the first round of 1965. Brady was in the sixth round in 2000. Pro seasons, Joe played 13 years. Brady has played 19 and counting, according to him. Super Bowl wins, Joe won one, and Brady, I believe, has just picked off a half a dozen. What were their Achilles heels on the field? Joe Namath had bad knees. Tom Brady is accused of being a slow runner. But off the field, Joe Namath was famous for women and booze, also booze and women. Brady, controversial body coach Alex Guerrero. And he said it. Joe said, I'm convinced I'm better than anyone else. Tom Brady says, I absolutely want to play better. So, there you go. Legends compared. Well, I guess Brady's legend in the making, right? Okay, from Annette Mitchell Plague of La Palma, California. Clothes make the man, and a good suit looks as good in the city as it does in the country. From his button-down vest to the crisp cut of his trousers, my father, Henry Mitchell, looked good in a suit, especially when standing in front of a convertible beside a smiling woman. When Daddy was in his mid-20s, he moved to Chicago, Illinois, where jobs were more plentiful than in his hometown of Granville, Iowa. During his 3 years there, he worked in the textile industry, selecting fabrics from woolen manufacturers to be made into tailored suits. He was offered a job as a detective on the Chicago police force because he had a talent for remembering people and their mannerisms. He turned the offer down because, my mother said, he very much liked his job in the clothing industry. In 1933, my father received a letter from Chicago. From his younger sister, Rose. She was getting married and wanted him home for the wedding. Having grown up in an area with a population of less than 400, my father knew everyone, including my mother. When she was 15, she told a friend he was the guy she was going to marry. So when he came back, she asked him to stay. He never did return to Chicago. In Iowa, Daddy worked as a telephone lineman, saving their money. My mother and the father were engaged for 2 years before marrying in 1936. Before long, they moved from their apartment in Granville to my grandparents' farm, northwest of town. 2 days after their first anniversary, August 15, 1937, I was born. Mother said I was her anniversary gift. When my parents weren't raising oats, corn, pigs, cattle, and chickens, or caring for their seven children, one of their favorite pastimes was taking drives in the country. As the first child, I got to ride in their roadster, telling my mother, "You ride in the rumble seat, I'll ride in the front seat by Daddy." My parents were married for 45 years until my father died in December 1981. Mom died in 93 in November of 2007. Reminisce Magazine wants you to tell us your story. Your true tales are the heart of this magazine, so dust off the photo album, high school yearbook, or vacation diary. And there's several different categories. And if you want to share your stories and digital photos, you can go to the website, reminisce.com/submit-a-story. And please include your full name, address, phone number, and email with every submission. So the topics can be anywhere from falling in love when it first hit. Were you all shook up, head over heels? Was it a crush or true love at first sight? No matter how your romance started, we want to hear about it. Label your story, falling in love. Giving thanks, kindness begets gratitude. And label your story about that subject matter, giving thanks. The funniest sibling, there's got to be one in every family, the joker, the prankster, the wild and crazy one. Label your story, funniest sibling. And the best 1960s memory, coming on the heels of 50s and the 1960s, were tumultuous, unnerving. So, what stands out for you? Label your story, best 1960s memory. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Reminisce. Be sure to tune in next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jim Butts for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time. Of yesteryear.